You are listening to Cut Jib Newsletter Speaks, the podcast, season 2, episode 9. This is Thursday, October 27th, 2022. JJ Sefton with CBD. And today we have a very, very special guest making a return to the show. He's been on a couple of times before, but this time it's to discuss a new book, which I think is, first of all, it's dynamite. And number two, it is probably one of the most important political tomes and calls to action and warnings that have come around in a long time. I'm speaking, of course, about the great Michael Walsh and his new book called Against the Great Reset, 18 Theses Contra the New World Order. CBD and Michael, welcome to the show. It's great to have you.
Good morning, folks.
So we are in the midst of this thing, and I think most people understand that there's a group in Davos, Switzerland, known as the World Economic Forum, and as I mentioned on the last podcast, it's not so much a three-headed Cerberus, but it's a multi-headed Hydra of some pretty freaking nasty individuals who, you know, if you didn't know better, you'd think they were out of a James Bond casting session to cast the next Blofeld. Speaking, of course, about people such as Klaus Schwab, George Soros, Hans-Jörg Wyss, and this Larry Fink character, among others, and a whole coterie of political and governmental and economic leaders around the world who fashion themselves as the elite who will be controlling a population of 8 billion people. And this whole thing got kicked off, or the most recent iteration, with the pandemic that happened that came out of China. But Michael, discuss a little bit. You know, you had a great introduction about it, but what is this all about? Who are these people? Better than I can explain it, and where is it heading?
Well, this is the return of Italian fascism 2.0. Basically, it's Mussolini Redux, or Reduce, as the case may be. Klaus Schwab, yeah, is the Bond villain from Germany, and he has ideas, yeah, and he has spread those ideas to other loathsome individuals, including Mr. Soros from Hungary and King Charles, the sovereign of the House of Saxe-Coburg und Gotha. Yeah, they changed the name during the war. Don't mention the war, you know, as they say in Fawlty Towers.
Yes.
Don't mention the name change. A lot of really bad guys are involved with this. They're climate hysterics. They're trust fund babies. They're do-gooders. They're people with way too much money and not enough brains. And the worst thing is they really hate us. Really hate us. They are transhuman to the point of anti-humanism. And by weaponizing the COVID virus, however, whether they were involved in the creation of it or whether they piggybacked on it, they see it as a great beta test of the New World Order, which is a phrase, by the way, as you guys know, goes back to Hitler. He began to use the expression, the Neue Weltordnung, on his rise to power. And it was echoed by, George Bush Sr. Yes, used the expression, the New World Order, too. And just because he was the former director of the CIA, I wouldn't want to make any linkage here, but hey, one can speculate when one can, right?
Well, yay, bipartisanship. It's so nice, right?
Oh, it's bipartisan. This is a bipartisan conspiracy, that's for sure.
Yeah, it's madness. I mean, this whole notion, really, and it goes back, as some of your authors, Victor Davis Hanson, of course, the great historian, and Roger Kimball, it just goes back to time immemorial about certain people think that they can perfect man and that God, yeah, God totally cocked the whole thing up and we have a better idea about how the world should be run. It's just recurring themes over and over again. It's the same shit, different millennium, really, but just with different actors. Mm-hmm. But this time, you know, they really have the ability. I guess they might have had the ability to do this with the technology of the time, however many centuries this has happened. But, I mean, it's really crazy now with technology and the information age the way it is, how they really probably could control 8 billion, unless you are living somewhere in a jungle in the Trobriand Island somewhere or off of the Bering Sea, they can control everybody on the planet in theory. And it's really, it's a frightening thing.
I think you have to also look at the arrogance of the concept of a new world order. I mean, there are many examples in history of the desire for a new order. American exceptionalism, I think, is probably the best and most successful example of that. People left Europe because they simply did not like that order came to the United States and created what I think is the greatest success story in the history of man. But their arrogance that they knew a better way did not extend past the borders of the United States, with certain fits and starts, obviously. Our world order now is a little bit too aggressive for my taste. But by and large, the arrogance that we know better remained within our borders. And that's what is, I think, terrifying about the New World Order today. That is that they truly believe, as Sefton just pointed out, that they can control 8 billion people based on their concept of how the world should be work. And that's obvious. Well, first of all, it won't work. And second of all, it's going to kill many, many people if they are successful in their plans.
Well, that's what they want. That's not a bug. That's a feature. Who is this fella who's just come recently to my attention named Harari? Do we know him? He gives TED Talks. He's an Israeli intellectual who thinks that the world would be much better off with about 500,000 people instead of 8 billion. He's become one of the foremost spokesmen for the New World Order as well. So you've got a mix of plutocrats, intellectuals, power-hungry, crazed Bond villains, all come together in this city, tiny little town, Dorf in German, called Davos, which is where, as I point out in my introduction in this Against the Great Reset, is where Hans Castorp goes to the sanitarium in The Magic Mountain by Thomas Mann, you know, one of the greatest novels of the 20th century. And I was quite influenced by it when I was a young man and just learning German as well. It's fitting that it's in Davos, of all places. And now from there, this is spreading. And CBD just said it's transnational. And it's proudly transnational. It's proudly anti-human. And it's proudly in favor of them over us.
Well, what's interesting is, you, Michael, you made a point of saying that these people, the dichotomy or the schizophrenia or dissonance of this thing is they have a better idea of how man should be, or, you know, ruled, controlled, or how the world should function. It's sort of this paternalistic, I think it was, it might have been even Roger Kimball mentioning it in the book, of Friedrich Hayek talking about the infantilization of populations. And yet your parents shouldn't want to kill you, you know, to make you a better person. I mean, there seems to be a little bit of a disconnect there. Yes, they want to have the betterment of mankind, but unfortunately they want to do away with mankind to have the betterment of mankind. I forgot who it was. I mean, it was attributed. I always thought it was another knucklehead who would fit right in with this crowd, Robert Moses, who ruled New York City for about 50 years, who once said, or supposedly had said, I love humanity, but I hate people. And I think that just kind of just goes with that, with the sentiment.
Yeah, well, he was another control freak who thought New York City would be better off if it was bulldozed so that the cars could drive through Greenwich Village. We see this all the time. In the new book I'm working on now, which is a sequel to Last Stands, it's another military history book, I'm at the Battle of the Milvian Bridge, which is where Constantine defeats his rival Western Emperor Maxentius and converts to Christianity and attributes his victory in this fight to seeing the sign of the cross, or the Cairo symbol for Christ, in the sky. And then overnight, less than a century, the Roman Empire has gone from persecuting Christians to making it the official religion of the empire. So my point with this is I've gone back into the Bibles to see how God treats us. And even God throws up his hands and says, the hell with people. He wipes them out. You know, Noah has to reboot the entire human race there. And there's this constant, in the Jewish Bible, there's a constant tension between God the Father, the Lord God and God. They appear to be almost two separate characters. One's kind of kindly and one's more remote, and one's very vindictive and petty and jealous. And then you get to the Christian Bible, where they have to invent out of completely whole cloth the idea that this itinerant rabbi that just got put to death by the Romans in the most humiliating way possible rose from the dead and actually, I forgot to mention, he's actually the Son of God. Yes, he is God. And that took a century to develop as well. So to the larger point, we're always trying to fix things, right? We look for a savior or a messiah, and it never comes. And even God throws up his, in the Jewish Bible, as you compare the order of the books to the Christian version of it, the Jewish Bible ends with God dropping out after he loses his fight with Job, which was a huge miscalculation on his part. And then he doesn't appear anymore. He no longer speaks to people. He's kind of washed his hands, whereas the Christian Bible reordered the books to put all the books of prophecy, which they vitally needed in order to prove the coming of Christ. So they backformed from Isaiah and the Old Testament prophets. And so you have two different versions of the same book. It's just reordered. And again, it gets to this point of how can we make man better? But even in the great faiths, man doesn't get better. Man is, the Christian version, he's got original sin. He's condemned unless he gets baptized and accepts Jesus. The Protestants take it even further into, we have to accept Jesus into your life or whatever. This madness just will never end. So we have to be aware that it's happening. And again, I'm not criticizing religion so much as to put it in a historical context. There's always this movement to control people.
But you just pointed out the glory of the founders of the United States, and that is that they recognized exactly what you just described and realized that the drive to perfect is a dangerous one, and yes, that the structure of the Constitution was such that it severely limited that drive to control. And yet they were also able to take the best parts of the Judeo-Christian tradition and create a template for people not to be controlled, but to be perhaps guided by the bare bone structure of government. Unfortunately, that has been, over the last 200 years has been bastardized beyond all recognition.
Yes.
So anyway.
Well, go
ahead. I was just going to make the quick point that the founders, you know, there's this argument among Christians, well, were they Christians or were they deists? I think very few of the prominent founders were faithful Christians in the sense of observant fidelity to dogma. I think they were all anti-dogmatists. And I think that's one of the reasons America started off so well, that they believed in a higher power, of course, which they paid tribute to, but they weren't tied down by petty regulations, and they created something really new. Now, control is the religious goal of the left. They don't have a faith in Judaism, Christianity, Islam, or Buddhism, or anything else. But they do have faith in controlling people for their own good. And they've broken through the strictures that the founders provided for in our Constitution. I've been writing a series of pieces on the amendments. As JJ knows, I did one against the 16th Amendment, one against the 17th. That's the income tax and the direct election. And the pieces I'm writing are not about the income tax. So I've gotten tons of letters from people saying, I have a better tax plan. I don't care about your tax plan, for crying out loud. What I care about was that gave the government the right to reach into your pocket. And it never had had that right before. And then the direct election of senators took the states. They fired the states from their very own thing. The Frankenstein monster ate Frankenstein. That's what happened with these amendments. So I'm moving on now to the 18th and the 21st, and then we'll finish with the glorious 19th.
Well, was the 18th was the 18th women's suffrage?
No, that's prohibition. Yeah,
women's suffrage. Yeah, get rid of that one.
Oh, I'm definitely. Oh, and you know what? Any sensible woman is also in favor of getting rid of it, because they vote their emotions and they vote for Democrats. So right off the bat, we're off to a terrible start.
Oh, well, that's the feminization of the United States.
Yeah.
They very carefully removed masculinity from the equation. I just wrote about that on Ace of Spades, about the military and the loss of the masculine ethic in our military. But if you remove masculinity from the voting patterns, you are left with the emotions that drive, let's face it, very, very bad voting patterns. And that's what we've got now.
Yeah, I mean,
we do. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, it's funny. I had a dear friend of mine who mercifully is one of us, although he has to sort of keep it on the down low. I remember a number of years back, he was talking about just the absolute war on masculinity that was going on. And I sort of really didn't realize it. I knew there was, you know, obviously crazy radical feminists and so on and so forth. But when he said, look, just take a look at TV commercials, take a look at TV shows, and or even just the commercials, every male that is ever depicted in any TV commercial on any product is always a bumbling, stumbling, oafish knucklehead. And it's the wife or the girlfriend or the daughter that has to save his ass from, you know, from buying the wrong cleanser or doing whatever the thing is that's going to blow up the house. And you just multiply, it's that kind of subtle. I mean, it is kind of subtle. You don't quite realize it. You just sort of, you laugh and you think, okay, you know, it's whoever the bumbling, it's the Ralph Crampton, and you kind of laugh at it. But it's insidious because there's a reason behind it, and the reason is to make men look stupid, to make men look like warmongers, to make men look oafish, to make men just look terrible, and it's women that need to be ruling the world. Which, by the way, I find very interesting in light of, you know, what's going on in the Ukraine, is that all the warmongers now are all these knuckleheads from the squad, whether it's Titicaca or Rancid Taliban or, you know, the Brofo or whoever it is. These are the ones that are screaming bloody murder that we should go in and, you know, have a nuclear war with Russia, because obviously if we don't, then they'll lose Congress. But that alone is just, you know, I don't know if that's related or an aside or it's or whatever, but
well, CBD's point about masculinity, you know, my book Last Stance is all about toxic masculinity. I gave a speech at Hillsdale about it called In Praise of Toxic Masculinity. And when the book came out, the whole introduction is about the masculine prerogative of war. That's what it is. It's something that men do. Women don't. They shouldn't be in the military, not in the field fighting. They're not equipped for it. They're not emotionally equipped for it. I mean, do we want bloodthirsty women? Good Lord, we would never have a chance against them if they started, turning into Roman legions, for crying out loud. And I think we've got to restore that. So in the next book, it's called A Rage to Live, A Time to Die. It's about great generals through history, and not one of them has been a woman. Alexander and Caesar, and later on Patton and Admiral Nimitz at the Battle of Midway. It is a masculine province, and I think if you let women run your country, which they've never run any country ever in the history of the world successfully, it will die. It will die because women prize security and safety, and they should. They're physically weaker than men. Even though we see in the movies that a 90-pound girl can kick the ass of a 260-pound special forces trained killer.
Of course.
They do that with one blow. They just knock them right over.
With one blow. Wait, your phrasing is bad there, but okay.
Well, that does make you weak at the knees. Let's face it, you know, from whichever direction that blow comes.
Exactly. Well, I will say this just to play, hello. We're not talking about Kamala here, folks, but I will say, to play devil's advocate here, I will say, you know, you could say Golda Meir. You could definitely say Margaret Thatcher, for sure.
Say Queen Elizabeth. But I think his point is well taken.
Yes,
that
it is.
That's that particular women can rise to the occasion. And I think there are examples throughout history. But obviously, in general, in the main, women cannot comport themselves well in wielding power responsibly.
No, for every Margaret Thatcher, I'll raise you a Liz Truss. How does she work out?
Or Madeleine Albright, dear
all
Lord.
All 47 days of her, or whatever that.
Yeah, or before her, what's her name? That big horsey girl who was prime minister for 5 minutes.
Big horsey girl.
Mrs. May, yeah.
Oh, yes. Theresa May, yeah, she was kind of big.
Just because Thatcher was a woman doesn't, you know, mean all women are equally capable of being Thatcher. That's obvious. But CBD just points out the vast majority, whether you like the world men create or not, you're stuck with it, ladies. So live with it.
Get me a sandwich and a beer. Hey,
me a sandwich. I'm telling
you, right? All right. Let's take a little bit of a break. We'll be back with CBD and the great Michael Walsh to discuss his new book, Against the Great Reset, on the Cut Kid Newsletter Radio Network. We'll be right back. And we're back, J.J. Sefton, CBD, and the great Michael Walsh discussing his latest important book, Against the Great Reset, 18 Theses Contra the New World Order, here on the Cut Jib Newsletter Speaks podcast. And CBD, I think you had some observations on the book itself.
Yes. When I got the advanced copy, I was immediately struck the way that Michael structured it. It's actually deceptively simple, but it makes it much easier to read. So he's got I'm trying to roll up to the top of it. He's got it broken down into sections, which are quite clever. He starts out with the problem, which is classic, and he's got three essays about that. Then the political, three essays, the economic, the personal, the practical, and the ineffable. And it flows rather well, and you're going to have to buy the book to see who he has writing. But I absolutely look forward to, especially a few, I'm not going to ruin it for the writers, but it's an interesting way of organizing a book of essays, which are usually tedious and chaotic. This is not tedious, and this is not chaotic.
Well, thank you very much, because that's a real compliment. A lot of things that we do as writers are hidden from the, from the effects. People go to the movie, they don't have to know how they did the special effect or how many times the writers had to rewrite that scene or any of the hidden 99% of the iceberg that you don't see. But for this book, I went into it with a very clear idea to structure it so that you could read it from start to finish, or you could read around in it, whatever you want. But I very consciously asked Victor to do, I have a little shorter introduction, and then Victor is the main introduction called The Great Regression. And then give it a flow and a tempo and end on more refined and spiritual things. So Richard Fernandez, who is a wonderful writer, lives in Australia, wrote about the conflict between faith and science. And I was like Dick Cheney. I was looking around for who's going to write the arts essay in this piece. And then I looked in the mirror and I said, oh, you are. Okay, right. So I ended with that because I wanted to go out on a non technical note. Now, David Goldman, who's just brilliant, I'm totally in awe of him, did us a piece on economics, of course, in China, which is a special area of interest / obsession, as I tease him constantly. So it does have a flow, and I'm glad that it worked for you, CBD, and that did take a lot of thought. None of that was accidental.
Well, I'm also glad to see that you have Angelo Codevilla, which, as Michael writes, the late Angelo Codevilla contributes what, alas, became his final essay. And that is tremendously sad for me because I've been reading him for many, many years. But it's wonderful. And of course, the topic of his essays is resetting the educational reset, which, I mean, we all are aware of what catastrophe has befallen education in the United States. And he discusses it. Anyway, folks, read the book. I'll just leave it at that.
CBD, you momser. I was going to bring up Angelo Codevilla, but yeah. you jumped in. But, really a lot of the wake-up call, so to speak, which I think I had not really heard of Angelo Codevilla. Codevilla, I think, is pronounced because Villa would be Spanish. Codevilla.
Yeah, and he rejected the Spanish pronunciation.
Yeah, it's Codevilla.
He's Italian.
That's why.
Born in Italy. Yeah.
I really did not know of him until the late, great Rush Limbaugh, peace be upon him, highlighted one of his essays called, it was The Country Class and the Ruling Class. Yeah. And that really crystallized in many ways a lot of my thinking and my observations about the world the way it really, and America, the way it really is, as opposed to the way we have always sort of hoped it would be or fantasized that it was. And obviously a lot of that, and I know your trepidations about Donald Trump and so on and so forth, but to me his greatest accomplishment was just the fact that he got elected and the fact that he was doing the things that he did to put America first and the American nation state first and American interest first, which flies directly in the face and contra to the Great Reset, is what really exposed the allies of the Great Reset, both in the Democrat Party and in the GOP, who are trying to take America and to knock it down and to make it just a vassal state of some world organization. His greatest accomplishment was exposing that. And a lot of that also came from Codevilla's essay, which really broke it down. It's the ruling class, and it's us proles. You will have nothing and love it, as Herr Schwab has dictated to us. So
yes, well, that's what they want and Hansen has been very eloquent on this subject too. In his book Mexifornia, and since then, they like Mexico. They want a caudillo system in which there are a few rich white people, and skin color is very important in Mexico. I grew up on the Mexican border, as a matter of fact, so you could see this very visibly among my childhood playmates. They want a vast peonage. It's like Cortez came back. You know, he's got 12 soldiers, 2 horses, and a set of steak knives, and he takes over the entire Aztec Empire, right? But the European ethnicity stays at the top of all of those South American systems in which the mestizos became the result of the inbreeding between the Europeans and the Indians. They want Mexico for us. A few people have all the money, Nancy Pelosi, et cetera, and the rest of them do your yard, you know, take care of your kids and wash the windows. That's it. That's the idea of the Great Reset in a nutshell. That's what they want.
Frightening. You blew me away. It is essentially, it's just, you know, we talk about the warning of invoking Godwin's law, but you know, Hitler and Mussolini and all the others, they just wanted they came in, they wanted these things, but the way they do it is through brute force, throwing people into concentration camps and death camps, and reordering society so that it better suits their control and the way they want to rule the world. Here you have essentially the same ends, but the means are only slightly different. That's not to say that they're not going to use brute force if they have to. If you just look back, whatever it was, 1969, 1970, Billy Ayers fantasized about Larry Grathwall was, I think he was an informer for, I hate to say the informer for the FBI, but at least he was an informer. And he was saying casually, they were at a meeting, when Ayers and company take over America and restructure it into a socialist paradise on Earth, unfortunately, or whatever it is, there are going to be about 25 million people who just won't accept it. And they'll have to be, shall we say, liquidated. Well, look who's running our country now. It's the acolytes of Bill Ayers. So if we don't accept what they're doing, we will be demonized, otherized, and like the guy, the poor hapless guy who was canvassing for Marco Rubio, you'll get the shit beat out of you. Or if you're a GOP ball team, you'll get shot up, you know, wherever. Or if you're a city that's mostly white, you'll get run over by a man of color in an SUV. So this is all state-sanctioned terrorism if you do not go along with their plans for you. And it's...
Look, the comparison...
Myrtleized. That's the word.
Myrtleized.
Sorry, go ahead.
Myrtleized.
The comparison with Nazi Germany, I think, is apt. The Nazis othered the Jews and communists and the infirm and the disabled and so on and so forth. They did it with perfectly, you know, they stuck to their... legal structures. Yes. We're doing it now, 80 years later, with deplatforming and banning from social media and the various other tools that a technological society has available to it. But it's happening, and the violence is coming. The murder of the retarded and the infirm in Nazi Germany in 1933, 1934 is functionally identical to the murder of the unborn in the United States starting in 1973. So I see no substantive difference.
There isn't any. They still want to kill you. It's just a question of how they're going to do it.
Exactly.
That's all. Exactly. You know, they're not going to dress up in really cool uniforms anymore and march around in jackboots and scare the shit out of everybody. They're going to do it in a stealth sort of every – like what Hitler – I mean, I spent many years in Germany, as you guys know. So both my children were raised there. My younger daughter was born there. I speak the language it's home to me in one sense, even though it's always going to be alien. Everything that Hitler did went step by step according to the law. And then when he didn't need the law anymore, that was the end of it. That's what these people will do as well. And they rely on our innate respect for the law, which won't save us in the end. I think that was that's the big takeaway I tell people all the time from World War II. Don't trust your lawyers, because in the end, they're not going to save you. You have to fight. You have to fight. And we're getting to that point. We are, because they're fighting us. We just refuse to accept it.
Yeah, I was going to say that they're not in uniforms, but no, they're in drag. That's the difference. It's, you're having a glitter bomb with, you know.
Well, luckily they wear masks, so we can tell who they are now. That's even That's great. I just love that.
Yeah, absolutely. But you, Michael, you and CBD, you both touch upon a subject that is, or a thought that is always, can I say the word niggling, or is that racist? A thought that is niggling in the back of my head about the future, insofar as, you know, as I've said, it's not that we are in a state of civil war. We're not in a state of civil war. We have a state of where one group of people is literally actively trying to either force the other side to get in line or to liquidate them. So this is, and as I said, this is a problem. When we have one side of the aisle, theoretically, people, or at least not the knuckleheads who are participating, like a Mitt Romney or whoever, but at least people who are trying to use a system that is so utterly corrupted, both governmentally, legally, socially, societally, culturally, whatever it is, they are trying to use a corrupted system in order to redress the grievances, which they have been abused in the first place. And it's just, I can't necessarily see that as effective. Again, this now touches upon the election that's coming up in about, I think, about 10 days. I'm not saying don't vote. You have to vote. You have to go out there and really overcome, and I hate this, overcome the cheat to at least put the brakes on this for at least the next 2 years. But the fact of the matter is, how are elections going forward in the long term going to solve this problem that is so structural and so ingrained? And now with Michael's book being directed both from Davos and from Beijing and from, you know, from Belgium and of course from Kalorama, everything is, elections just ain't going to necessarily cut it. But again, you know, it's a real problem.
Well, I think we missed an opportunity with Trump. There's no question. He had, inchoate as they were, a lot of good ideas, and he understood the practical problem. But he was so poor in his choice of personnel for the first 3.5 years that and the Ivanka, as they were called around the White House, the Democrats, that would be his daughter and her husband. They sabotaged him at every step of the way. So he was constantly hamstrung. The moment he got rid of Mike Flynn on no pretext at all, you knew that he had already rolled. I think if we have a clean sweep, what we need is fewer baby boomers. And I speak as a charter member of that particular crew. You've got to get rid of the baby boomers, because we were the biggest generation in American history. We showed up at kindergarten. There were 50 other assholes sitting in our seats. And we realized we were like rats. We were going to have to fight for everything we had. So we split. And now you see, you know, I coined the term the Cold Civil War more than 12 years ago. And after a while, people started to think Angelo had coined that, because he picked it up from me, or maybe he invented it separately, but it was later. So I used to always tease Angelo about, I copyrighted the Cold Civil War, but we have a Cold Civil War among the baby boomers. And as soon as you get us off the stage, you'll be a happier country, which is why I don't want to see Trump run again. I want to see the end of the Clintons and the Pelosis. And we're being run by a gerontocracy, for crying out loud, who are still fighting the same stupid fights we had in 1968. Now, really, that's ridiculous. Time for us to go. I volunteer. I'm going home to Ireland. The hell with you guys.
Yes, I'm sure your German and your Yiddish will stand you in good stead, but as you order or whatever.
The Germans used to ask me, so how come you speak so good German, they would say. And I would say, Selbstverteidigung, which means self-defense.
Exactly.
And they thought about that for a minute, and then they go, aha, right.
Yeah. Well, Germany, now it's, that country, Europe is, you know, and CBD and I and a couple of the other co-bloggers who on the other podcasts, we're sort of having a nice, more German, more Schadenfreude about what's coming to Europe. Probably going to freeze their asses off, because they got on board this whole green climate change reset bullshit. And but in the meantime, they relied on Russia to give them their gas. But now Russia turned off the spigot, or blew up the pipeline, or maybe we blew up the pipeline to make it look like the Russians blew up the pipeline. We don't know. Europe is going to, you know, now all of a sudden they're scrambling for more coal, more gas, and more nuclear power. So I guess in a weird, twisted way, maybe this was kind of a, you know, sort of a silver lining to this whole thing, to slap people silly saying this green nonsense is nonsense, or maybe it isn't. Maybe they still believe in man-made global warming.
But they want to believe in it, but just today the Germans decided to tear down a wind farm and open a coal mine. Yep, I mean, did you see that, CBD? I love that.
Yeah, I was just about to mention that. It's delicious, the irony of that.
And our problem in Ireland, if I may speak my beloved people, is we're really stupid. And as I always say on Irish radio, the smart ones got on the boat and the dumb ones stayed home, which endears me to my relatives, naturally. But the Irish believe that this little tiny island, which has the population of Brooklyn, is somehow affecting the entire world's climate. And the government there is trying to put us all out of business. We have cattle is the basis of our economy, and it has been for 2,000 years. All cows must go. They fart, methane, global warming. We have this wonderful giant river, the third largest river in Europe, called the Shannon River, which some German engineers came in after we were free from 700 years of you-know-who. And we started building infrastructure because we had none. The British wouldn't let us have any. We built a huge hydroelectric plant. They want to close that down. That provides electricity. It was like the electrification of the Soviet Union. All of a sudden, Ireland was electrified because of this naturally, the power of the Shannon. They want to literally want to close it down. They don't want you to be able to buy an oil burner to heat your house. They don't want you to use wood for a fire. They won't let you build a new fireplace if you're renovating your house or building a new house. And cruelest blow of all, especially for us in the West country, out in the County Clare, is... And by the way, JJ, you've got a great little Irish cap on today, which I think is...
Oh, thank you very much.
Very exciting. But they won't even let us burn turf. You know, we're so poor, we burn dirt, literally burn dirt to heat our houses. And now they won't let you even burn dirt. So it's a mania that has gripped Europe. And the Irish will come out of it when the Germans do, because we do what we're told. So if the Germans are tearing down wind farms... Great. I was driving before I left Ireland a couple years ago. I was driving around my area, and all of a sudden I see a giant windmill in the middle of the most beautiful Irish scenery. You know, one thing we got is scenery, right? And there's this bleeping windmill. And I thought, oh my God, surely we can't be this stupid. But here we are. Anyway, our little website, thepipeline.org, which I'm very pleased you guys have cited from time to time. We are against this sort of nonsense, and we are going to fight it till the last windmill's down. That's it.
Well, I hope it. I hope they tear this crap down before you bug out and go there. But we don't know. I mean, there was one other thing. I think. Well, it's not Ireland, but I guess maybe it's the same thing over on the other side in Scotland, because I think they were the knuckleheads were trying to, and I'm sure people will be enraged over this. They were trying to ban the production of whiskey because of the peat.
Yes.
Besides burning peat, it's vital for for brewing a whiskey. So it's like,
hey, dude, we invented whiskey. The Irish and the
Whiskabag.
Whiskabag. Yeah, the water of life.
Yeah.
We invented it, and now they're going to say to us and our poor, younger, dumber, stupider brothers, the Scots, that we can't have peat anymore. Come on.
Well, you know,
this is fighting words, in my opinion.
Absolutely.
We're laughing about this, but it also raises an interesting question, which I think CBD, you were talking about, and obviously Angelo Codevilla was mentioning in the book about the education system. At a certain point, you're going to indoctrinate another generation or two or three generations of people into thinking that their heritage is terrible. Their country is terrible. Their parents are terrible. Christianity is terrible. And as the last and previous generations die off, whether voluntarily or otherwise, the gas chambers or Billy Eyre's Einsatz group in fantasies, as they die off and disappear from the collective memory dies off. So all of a sudden you'll have Scottish people who don't know from Scotch, or Irish people who don't know from whiskey, or don't know from any of these things, and they won't necessarily miss it, just as they won't necessarily miss their freedoms, or will they? One of our colleagues, and he's great, and maybe you've heard him on previous podcasts, Dave in Florida, who is a brilliant pollster and really understands the election processes, but his philosophical viewpoint is that somehow whatever happens, even whatever the hell we have to go through, the desire for freedom and the desire for liberty and all these things that God has given us instinctively and intuitively will not die. And he's a much more, I guess he's more of an optimist maybe than I am. I try to be an optimist, but even still, when you kill off the collective memory, you have willing population of sheep. I mean, you don't necessarily have to import them from south of the border, but which is exactly what they're doing, but for that purpose. But you know,
they're doing it everywhere. In Ireland, the question is now, how come whenever we see you know, depictions of our history, everybody's white? Seriously. And people say that's because there weren't any black people. They hadn't even been encountered by, well, the Irish didn't encounter anybody. They were all sitting there in that little island. But we now have the new Irish, which is we're importing people from Central Africa. My little village is awash in Ukrainians right now. Awash. The government has decided to settle a lot of the refugees in our little village, population 500. And 1 million Ukrainians. And before that, it was 1 million Arabs and Afghanis and whoever fled whatever the wars are. Ireland believes that it should house the entire population of the world. So this is where we're at, because the memory is being destroyed. The church managed to kill itself, which I'm sorry to see that it happened, but it was fully earned. They did it the old-fashioned way. It's just the one good thing is that my granddaughters, they go to a Irish school, Irish public school, but it's a Catholic school, of course. It's left over from that era, and they're learning the Irish language. And most Irish kids today don't have their white boy names anymore. We've abandoned those. So I even go by my real name, which is Michael Branagh.
So Michael Walsh is your slave name?
That's my slave name.
Got it.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
The Brits gave that. So Michal Branagh is my real name, and my I have a granddaughter with an Irish name that no one can pronounce, and it's great. I love to see that, and I notice all the kids in my little farming area are all named Niamh and Siobhan and Sinead and some names that you know that you've heard of and other names you haven't, and the boys are Michal and. Sean, Seamus, we're back, baby. Look out.
So getting back to the point about the collective consciousness of freedom that Dave in Florida has discussed as inevitable, that we will find it again. You know, you look throughout history and you see examples of terrifying dictatorships. And in the midst of them, you see these little sparks of freedom. And it's fascinating. I think it describes the human condition rather well. I think back to, what was it, the Gdansk shipyard, 1981, when a welder, or I've forgotten what he was, decided that he didn't like being a slave to the Soviet Union.
Right.
And fast forward a few years later, and the Soviet Union fell with help from some great, great people, not the least of whom was the then current Pope. So the question is the destruction of Ireland with unfettered immigration, the destruction of the United States with unfettered immigration, is that going to finally put a stake in the heart of that collective consciousness, that desire for freedom? Are they finally able to import enough people who simply do not have it in their DNA?
Yeah, see, I disagree.
That is their hope. I don't think it's true, but that is certainly their hope.
I disagree with Dave in Florida. I disagreed with George Bush in that silly second inaugural address he made. I don't think the desire for freedom burns in every human heart. I'd prove it. Prove it. Seriously, prove it. I think it's almost exclusively a Western phenomenon. And we have grown up, thanks in part to the Enlightenment and then to the Reformation and the Counter-Reformation and the intellectual ferment, the rediscovery of our Greco-Roman past, thanks in part to the fact that the Arabs preserved a lot of the writings of Plato and Aristotle, and then we managed to reconnect with them long after the fall of Rome and even after the fall of Constantinople. I don't know that it burns in every heart. I'll tell you, I was there I had a front row seat for the end of the Cold War. I was in Berlin when the wall came down. I had a piece of it in my library in the next room here that I hammered out myself. And I had a lot of friends on the other side. I spent most of my time there in East Berlin, sometimes Moscow, sometimes in Leningrad, but mostly in Eastern Europe, in East Germany in particular. And a lot of the freedom, well, yes, it was a desire for freedom, but it was a desire for stuff. The guys I knew, what I always used to love about the old Soviet Union and communism in general is you could bribe your way through that country and live absolutely happily ever after, as long as you had real money. They had no real money. So as a result, everybody was for sale. Every band was you could bribe them. Every woman would sell herself if she had the slightest chance of doing so. It was so depressing and so corrupt and so awful. And a lot of the impulse to freedom was, yes, freedom, but also I want to make money. I will work the system however I can in order to have a better life. But I think it's a Western thing. Has China ever had a freedom movement ever that wasn't Western? I mean, they have a government that's already Western inspired. It's Marxist, Leninist, communist. They had to import that from us. That's because they all went to France and studied at the Sorbonne, I guess. I don't know. I just don't know. I'm not sure that that's true. You look at Rome and it had for whatever ills it had, it lasted 2,000 years, which is a hell of a lot longer than we're going to last. That's for sure. And they didn't have any notions of this freedom. Man earned what he could fight for and get. You know, their idea of heaven, the pre Judeo-Christian heaven was there is no heaven. You live the best life you can. You go out and take as many of the bastards with you. And then you go down to Hades, which is this gloomy, depressing place. And that's it. There is no afterlife. There's only what you can get in the here and now. I've decided to convert to Zeus, I think. I think that's where I'm going.
I thought you were channeling, you know, John Lennon and Yoko Ono there, but
no.
Because that's imagine, you know, imagine. Well, imagine there's no heaven, but there certainly is a hell.
Yeah, well, that's for God. Sure. It's tricky. It's a tricky concept. I'd like to believe it's true. I'm not sure it is. Sorry.
Yeah. Well, you can only think that people. Well, look at it this way: forgetting about freedom or forgetting about. Liberty or whatever it is, higher aspirations or just living, you know, just being left alone. I think maybe that's enough. Maybe just people will have a sense of, you know, I'm tired of this guy, you know, hitting me with a whip in the galley there to pull the oar harder. And I kind of want to get up on the deck and get a fresh ocean breeze. Maybe that's just enough. Just that spirit of just wanting to break free of that will collectively drive people if our collective memory is burned out of us. God forbid, by these bastards in Davos. The Davos, Beijing, Brussels axis, I suppose it is.
Axis of evil.
It really is an axis of evil. But going back to CBD, what you talked about, the importation of mass migrations, whether intentionally, not intentionally, or whatever, at least look what happened in Sweden or the elections there. Look what happened in Italy with Giorgia Meloni. Right. The people have woken up to this and they understand, look, this is not good. Is it too late for them? It may very well be. I mean, if you look at Sweden, that's almost basically an Islamic republic at this point. But
and the rape capital of Europe too.
The rape capital of Europe. So France, I think, is shot. I don't think they have it. They're gone. But in Britain, probably the same thing. But some people are waking up to this, and hopefully, it's not too late over here. We shall see.
Well, that's why
France woke up. Probably 40 years too late. Yep. You know, the right in France is slowly gaining traction, and perhaps in 5 years or 10 years, Le Pen will become the prime minister. The issue, of course, is that the vast majority of those people who are most willing to destroy France are now citizens of France. And that is their existential problem, and there is simply nothing they can do about it. There are many French citizens who hate France.
They're not going to be able to like to strip 5 million people of citizenship and deport them to Madagascar. There you go. Have another Avion conference, my friends. There you go, France.
I wouldn't be so sure of it. When the Europeans get the bit between their teeth, they'll do stuff like strip 5 million people of citizenship, put them on a boat, and send them back. They actually will do that. We've seen this movie before, have we not, gentlemen?
Yeah, we have. And I simply don't think that it's in there. In them yet, and I don't think it ever will be, but it's a valid point. They certainly have it in their history.
Let's take a little bit of a break. We've gone long, but it's been a great conversation so far with CBD JJ Sefton and the great Michael Walsh to discuss his brand new book, which you must buy, Against the Great Reset, 18 Theses Contra the New World Order. We will be back in just a moment to talk more. And that concludes part one of our interview with Michael Walsh. Look for part two, linked here at cutjibnewsletter.com, in the sidebar at Ace of Spades HQ, on Rumble, and on Apple Podcasts.